Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Greetings and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, Chair of the Club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum and member of the Board of Governors, and I will be your chair for today's program. I'd like to welcome our radio audience and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's speaker is the Honorable Shirley Ann Jackson, Ph.D., President of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York. She has held senior leadership positions in government, industry, research, and academia. Her research and policy focus includes energy security and the national capacity for innovation, including addressing the quiet crisis of looming gaps in the science, technology, and engineering workforce and reduced support for basic research. A theoretical physicist, she was chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission from 1995 to 1999 in the Clinton administration. She is a vice chairman of the Council on Competitiveness and co-chairs its Energy, Security, Innovation, and Sustainability Initiative. She is past president and chairman of the board of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a member of the National Academy of Engineering, the American Philosophical Society, and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Physical Society, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She is a member of the Board of Directors of the New York Stock Exchange Euronext and serves on the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian Institution and as a director of IBM, FedEx, Marathon Oil, Medtronic, and PSEG. She is also a member of the Board of the Council on Foreign Relations. Recently, calling her a national treasure, the National Science Board selected her as its 2007 Vannevar Bush Award recipient for a lifetime of achievements in scientific research, education, and senior statesmanlike contributions to public policy. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Shirley Jackson.
Thank you. Well, good evening. Professor Curtis, thank you for inviting me to speak about one of the most vexing and urgent challenges we face, which is inextricably interlinked with our economic security and our national security, and that is energy security. The exponential growth in demand for energy presents both extraordinary challenges and offers equally extraordinary economic opportunities. A multiplicity of converging factors makes it bluntly obvious that a comprehensive global energy system restructuring has begun. The question is, will the United States lead the inevitable restructuring, or will it occur without us? Whichever it is, we are challenged to think about energy in new ways. Proper framing is necessary for informed choice and effective action. If we fail to think about the issue appropriately, if we trivialize the complexities or yield to the temptation for a magical quick fix, we will not get there from here. In other words, we need a comprehensive energy security roadmap. That means we must know where we are and where we must go. We must get the goal right, get the plan right, and get it done. The combined forces of energy supply uncertainty, rising energy costs, and the impact of climate change are major drivers of global energy restructuring. Let us examine some of the elements of this. First, new energy markets are developing worldwide, providing opportunity and options for new players. Second, new major players have emerged who are changing the terms of reference for traditional energy behemoths, especially with regard to oil and gas supply. Third, nations are realigning in new ways, shifting old alliances. Fourth, with rising energy costs, corporations are swiftly realigning their priorities, changing how they do business, and making investments to secure market opportunity. Fifth, climate change mitigation and new markets also are driving new trading schemes and investments in new sources and new technologies. And sixth, oil-generated wealth and other actions are changing who plays in global financial markets. I will explore each of these elements, but to begin, I suggest that we change our language, that we move beyond the term energy independence. There is no energy independence. Of the approximately 190 countries in the world, not one is energy independent, nor is likely to be anytime soon. Now, new energy markets are emerging because worldwide energy consumption is rising exponentially, driven by population growth, swiftly developing economies, improving living standards, and burgeoning energy-dependent technologies. For example, the growth in energy consumption in China is illustrated first by new cars being added to the streets of Beijing last year at a rate of approximately 1,000 cars per day. Or second, by China adding 50,000 to 80,000 megawatts of electrical generating capacity, roughly equivalent to the entire electrical grid of England each year for the past few years. Consumption worldwide of nearly every major energy source has increased markedly. If the current trends continue, humans will use more energy over the next 50 years than in all of previously recorded history. And fossil-based energy sources, including coal, will remain a dominant part of the primary energy mix for some time. The original Seven Sisters, Western companies that controlled Middle East oil after World War II, are losing prominence to a new set of seven: Saudi Aramco, Russia's Gazprom, China's CNPC, NIOC of Iran, Venezuela's PDVSA, Brazil's Petrobras, and Petronas of Malaysia controlled almost a third of the world's oil and gas production and more than a third of its total reserves. The old Seven Sisters, which became four companies after mergers in the 1990s, Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP, and Royal Dutch Shell, produce about 10% of the world's oil and gas and hold just 3% of reserves. The International Energy Agency estimates that 90% of new production supplies over the next four decades will come from developing countries, a big shift from the past 30 years when 40% came from industrialized nations. This asymmetry is leading supply countries and their national oil companies to continually change contract terms with traditional international oil and gas companies and to shift alliances in order to have greater ownership of assets and a concomitant greater share of revenues. The fact that many of the new sisters are state-owned and that the growth in the oil and gas industry rests in their hands largely is restructuring national and international alliances and will impact them for decades to come. Let me illustrate this complexity with a recent example. GasUnie, the Dutch national gas company, has taken a stake, a 9% stake, in the controversial Nord Stream pipeline project. The pipeline, controlled by Gazprom, the Russian gas monopoly, would carry gas directly from Russia under the Baltic Sea to Germany, bypassing Poland, Belarus, Ukraine, and the Baltic states. Now, some countries, the Baltic states in particular, are objecting to the pipeline on the basis of environmental concerns. For others, such as Poland, it means a revenue loss from transit fees. For still others, it can affect supply, namely Ukraine. The deal also gives Gazprom the option to acquire from GasUni a 9% stake in the Balzand-Bakhtin pipeline connecting the Netherlands and the UK. This would give Gazprom a stake in a British supply pipeline for the first time. Now, such moves reflect energy supply concerns in EU countries, which as a group import 80% of their oil and gas, 80%. And these moves are worrisome as well because Russia very assiduously uses its oil and gas abundance to lock up deals with more and more European countries, even as many of them fret about Russia using its dominant energy position as a political tool. This has prompted the EU to develop strategies for new and renewable resources of energy and energy efficiency, both to assure supply through diversification and to mitigate climate change. China itself is on a worldwide march to lock up energy supplies, as well as access to other resources such as minerals and heavy metals. This especially is seen in its presence in Africa, where it trades infrastructure development, sometimes education, and always embassy presence and diplomatic recognition for such access. I've seen it directly myself. China also is projected to outpace the U.S. as the largest emitter of greenhouse gases and other pollutants within a couple of years. Therefore, it is important, in fact, to help rapidly developing countries like China to gain energy efficiencies in manufacturing and in products, while reducing their carbon footprint through the use of renewable and alternative energy sources. In fact, multinational corporations are working with their Chinese suppliers to help them reduce costs by reducing energy use and carbon load, often employing new management techniques and new technologies. Worldwide, corporations are making large capital investments in renewable energy technologies. A 2007 report by the United Nations Environment Program's Global Trends in Sustainable Energy Investment found that investment capital flowing into sustainable energy projects, especially wind, solar, and biofuels, more than doubled in just 2 years, from $28 billion in 2004 to $71 billion in 2006. The International Energy Agency estimates that as much as $16 trillion will be invested in the energy sector through 2030. Now, the emergence of the sisters I mentioned from oil-rich countries has been the basis for the creation of so-called sovereign wealth funds. And these are nation-owned entities that have used primarily oil revenues to accumulate and manage national funds for investment objectives. Sovereign wealth funds have emerged as important new players in global financial markets and may affect and will affect and are affecting energy markets. Worldwide, it is estimated that some $3 trillion have been assembled in sovereign wealth funds, especially out of the Middle East. And this figure is likely to reach $7.5 trillion by 2012. The availability of these substantial funds, their sovereign support, and their appetite for risk offer both challenges and opportunities for governments and corporations, and is changing behaviors between and among these entities. These funds, together with central banks in emerging markets, hedge funds, and private equity, have moved to participate in IPOs, provide additional financial backing in business deals, and take major financial stakes in investment banks. I'm sure you've heard about that lately. And in various stocks and other financial instruments. So as we shape our national energy goals and strategies, we must understand and account for the comprehensive global energy system restructuring, its impact on markets, and national alignments. So let us move to the national context. Consider just one element of the U.S. energy dilemma, our dependence on imported oil. As a nation, we use roughly 20 million barrels of oil a day, nearly one quarter of global consumption, yet we produce just over 5 million. So a question is this: would it be feasible, using new fuel technologies, greater efficiency in energy deployment and use, and collective conservation, to reduce our petroleum consumption to match our domestic supply capacity? Is it feasible to quadruple our fossil fuel capacity through exploration and offshore drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge or through oil sands production and the like? And if it is feasible, should we immediately execute a strategy to make this happen? How would we then manage environmental impact and climate change concerns? If this is not feasible, or we are concerned about climate change and environmental impact to the extent that we are not willing to do this, then we must think differently and strategically about energy. In many aspects, this challenge is not new. In 1973, President Nixon called for energy independence, responding to the OPEC oil embargo. Project independence lowered highway speeds, converted power plants to coal, prompted completion of the Trans-Alaskan pipeline, and diverted federal highway construction funds to mass transit. The Ford administration made attempts towards securing our national oil supply. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve was a notable accomplishment. While President Carter's characterization of the energy problem as the moral equivalent of war was widely mocked, it produced a comprehensive national energy plan stressing conservation, renewable energy, and research. Have you heard that before? And though his program lost momentum, some proposals, such as building appliance and automobile fleet efficiency standards, were enacted and have endured to our benefit. The pattern of advance and retreat on energy policy has been repeated over the past several decades. Every few years, an event, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, rolling brownouts here in California, drill rig and refinery damage by Hurricane Katrina, skyrocketing prices at the gasoline pumps, and so on, stir attention, trepidation, and typically short-lived action. Moreover, over the last 30 years, the U.S. has gone from importing a third of our oil in 1973 to nearly three-quarters today. The U.S. paid out $327 billion for oil imports last year, and the price of oil has now doubled over 2007 levels with significant economic consequence. So this time, we must get the goal right. This time, we must find real, lasting solutions. Not only must we reformulate our relationships to energy as a nation and as consumers, but we also must seize economic opportunity and embrace new industries that will emerge to sustain and to grow our economy as a result of what may seem a very painful exercise today. Now, I would define energy security this way: as having an adequate and sustainable supply of energy to meet the needs and aspirations of citizens, commercial enterprises, and public sector functions, and to provide that supply in as environmentally benign a way as possible. The practical definition, that is, the set of strategies for achieving energy security, varies according to nation and region. To reach it for the United States, we must build a comprehensive energy security roadmap. At its core, the roadmap should adhere to six basic principles. First, redundancy of supply and diversity of source. where optimum source is linked to specific sector of use. This entails maximizing domestic production and ensuring reliable sources for necessary fuel imports. This provides protection against supply disruption, such as natural disasters or geopolitical instability, and provides a hedge against price volatility. Second, support for well-functioning energy markets. This includes transparency of fuel pricing and other energy generation costs, as well as mechanisms to secure financing for long-term strategic investments. The latter is frequently a sticking point for developing countries and sometimes for developed ones. This may require new schemes and instruments for trading in energy markets while monitoring to avoid intense speculation or market manipulation that can drive volatility. Third, investment in sound infrastructure for energy generation, transmission, and distribution, including the necessary regulatory and operational protocols to ensure the safe, secure, and reliable performance of refineries, power plants, the electrical grid, and other facilities. Fourth, providing for environmental sustainability and energy conservation with calculation of full life cycle costs, including the environmental impact of every proposal, program, and product, and the cost of energy source development from production through use and eventual disposal. Related to life cycle is the potential for unintended consequences. The compact fluorescent light bulb, for example, uses less electricity than incandescents and saves 2,000 times its weight in greenhouse gases. But it contains mercury and requires safe, convenient, and hopefully ultimately inexpensive disposal. Moreover, the carbon cost of its production must be included in the equation. Fifth, the development of policy alternatives that include consistency of regulation and transparent price signals. An example relates to the carbon content of fuels, processes, and commercial and consumer goods. The Congress has focused on reducing carbon content or carbon dioxide production from point sources through financial incentives, primarily through a cap and trade system for carbon dioxide in which allowances would be sold, and the amounts of the allowance would ratchet down every year. Now, many in the business community have proposed and would prefer a carbon tax to induce reduction of carbon dioxide emissions. Companies are beginning to consider the carbon and energy content of their products, sometimes in anticipation of regulation, sometimes in response to state regulation, sometimes for good business reasons. However, many do not or cannot measure carbon dioxide emission in their supply chains. The feasibility of either a carbon tax or a cap and trade system will depend upon consistent definition and measurement of true carbon content of products and processes. And sixth, to reemphasize one I mentioned earlier, linking optimum source to specific sector of use. This entails thinking strategically about how each usage sector, electricity generation, residential and commercial heating and cooling, construction, transportation, etc., is matched to the supply source that will be most efficient, cost-effective, sustainable, and reliable. Now, this principle suggests that we ask not only where conversion from fossil fuels is possible, but where it is possible first. While ground transportation may run acceptably on electricity, airlines, at least at this point, clearly cannot. I wouldn't want to be on the plane. Source for sector of use suggests that we may want to reserve a portion of our fossil fuel to the airline industry, which supports about 33 million jobs internationally, accounts for 7.5% of global domestic product, and is essential to the global economy. If a decision is taken, for instance, to promote plug-in hybrid vehicles, the resulting greater dependency on electricity and the power plant fuel and capacity to generate that electricity must be taken into account. In addition to these principles, a comprehensive energy security formula must support continuing robust innovation, both in terms of technological advances as well as in business process innovations, policy alternatives, and the capital to bring these things to market. We must innovate the technologies that uncover and exploit new fossil energy sources and improve their extraction. We must innovate the technologies that conserve energy and protect the environment. And we must innovate the technologies that will lead to alternative energy sources that are reliable, cost-effective, safe, as environmentally benign as possible, and sustainable. Innovation and investment in both existing and new technologies are important. The challenges are great, but provide tremendous economic opportunity. For existing technologies, developments in wind, solar, and nuclear, for instance, are showing great potential. The New York Times earlier this month called wind the new oil. New blade designs and innovation in flexible composite materials have cut down times for wind turbines, resulting in energy costs of about 8 cents per kilowatt hour, competitive with natural gas and even coal-fired power stations, where they retrofitted for carbon capture and sequestration. Smarter grids using direct rather than alternating current can extend transport over longer distances and underwater and help to mitigate irregular wind patterns. Solar is another alternative where cost per kilowatt hour has fallen from 50 cents in 1995 to 20 cents in 2005 and is expected to decline further. Current systems utilize photovoltaic cells, heliostatic mirror or lens systems for steam-based electricity generation, or an intriguing experimental combination of the two. And of course, I couldn't stop without talking about nuclear. Now, nuclear power in principle satisfies many optimum requirements for enhancing energy security with minimal environmental impact. The complete cycle from resource extraction to waste disposal emits only about 2 to 6 grams of carbon equivalent per kilowatt hour, about the same as wind and solar if one includes construction and component manufacturing, and is about 2 orders of magnitude below coal, oil, and natural gas. Unlike small wind and solar facilities, it can supply the stable baseload capacity needed to support urban centers and to stabilize large electrical grids. Operating costs are low, although nuclear power plants are capital intensive and require a sophisticated regulatory infrastructure to ensure independent safety oversight. But accounting for all costs, new nuclear power plants can produce electricity at a cost of between 4.9 and 5.7 cents per kilowatt hour. The Achilles heel, however, is management and disposal of spent nuclear fuel. Global annual nuclear waste, about 10,000 tons, with 2,000 tons from the U.S., is small when contrasted with the 29 billion tons of fossil fuel carbon waste released annually into the atmosphere. But nuclear waste is waste that must be handled very carefully. And public opinion likely will remain skeptical until a waste repository or other fuel cycle closure solutions are demonstrated. Part of the investment in existing technologies must be renewal of key aspects of our national infrastructure, long a concern. I already mentioned California brownouts and rolling blackouts, but there's hurricane damage to Gulf-based drill rigs and refineries as graphic illustrations of the need both to sustain our existing infrastructure and to accommodate additional baseload. But the real excitement lies in the innovation of new technologies and the abundant economic opportunities they may present. Again, we can examine only a few. New nano-engineered materials hold great potential to improve existing solar technologies and to provide climate-responsive cladding for buildings. For example, at my own institution, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, where nanotechnology is a major research focus, scientists have created the darkest man-made material yet, which could be used to boost the efficiency of solar energy conversion. Other Rensselaer researchers have added copper nanorods to the bottom of a metal vessel, increasing boiling efficiency by an order of magnitude, which could improve the heat transfer of solar power generation. Applied in tandem, these innovations could boost the efficacy of large-scale solar power generation. Bioenergetics are yielding fascinating possibilities. You know, algae is being developed as a source of biofuel that both sequesters carbon dioxide as it grows and does not impinge upon fuel production. It grows rapidly into a high-yield biomass, producing high-grade lipids for refining into biofuel, yielding about 30 times more energy per acre than land-based crops. And it is possible to select an algae strain to generate particular carbon chains needed for jet fuel, for example. Jatropha is a deciduous, drought-resistant perennial that grows quickly in marginal soil, producing seeds with a 37% oil content. The unrefined oil can be used directly as fuel and has been tested successfully in unmodified diesel engines. Unlike other vegetable oils from rapeseed or soya, Jatropha oil is not edible, so it is not a crop competitor. Already, Indian Railways are using a Jatropha oil diesel mix in its diesel engines, and Air New Zealand will test Jatropha fuel in one of its Boeing 747-400 aircraft this year, and they intend to have it go through one engine and regular jet fuel go through the other. Now, coal is and is likely to remain the most widely used energy source, at least for the short to intermediate term, which is why cleaner coal technology is so important through clean chemical and biological processes. The National Energy Technology Laboratory, a DOE, a Department of Energy agency, suggests that post-combustion, pre-combustion, and oxy-combustion capture systems that are under development are expected to capture more than 90% of flue gas CO2 from point sources and to reduce costs by 45%. Currently, though, the costs of capture infrastructure are high, and there is concern for the efficacy and safety of long-term underground sequestration. And this has led some people to focus on closing the carbon cycle, either through chemical or biologically inspired processes. And there are other examples, including in the nuclear arena, and I assume that someone will ask me about that. And like corporations and markets, states, notably California and even cities, already are enacting legislation and regulations addressing both energy security and climate change mitigation, and like corporations, are exploiting economic opportunity. But if a roadmap is to achieve these step changes, it will require consistent, sustained, long-term investment in basic research. And federally funded research, especially in the physical sciences and engineering, has declined dramatically since the 1970s. As a result, the United States is experiencing a significant advanced technology trade deficit. The U.S. share of global technology exports was 29%. In 1980, As of 2005, it had fallen to 12%, less than half. Now, one might expect that as other economies develop and rise and develop their own technologies and industries. But we don't want to have global trade deficits. Innovation requires investment in research and development, but innovation fundamentally requires people. The question is, are we as a nation equipped with the human capital for the robust innovation the energy challenge demands of us? As a university president and as a theoretical physicist, I have deep concerns that our national innovation capacity is in jeopardy. We're still strong, but the question is it in jeopardy? Because converging forces have created what I call the quiet crisis, which is eroding the production of scientists, mathematicians, engineers, and technologists we need. The scientists and engineers who came of age in the post-Sputnik era are beginning to retire. At the same time, we're no longer producing sufficient numbers of new graduates in this country to replace them. And this looming talent gap already is becoming evident in the nuclear and the oil and gas energy sectors. Fortunately, we continue to attract exquisite talent from abroad. We attract talented international scientists, engineers, and graduate students, but we do not let enough of them in. Besides, other nations are investing in their own education and research enterprises, offering new opportunities for their own scientists and engineers to study and to work at home. The flattening world means that they, too, can find employment elsewhere, not necessarily in the United States. And finally, our demographics have shifted. The new majority in the United States now comprises young women, and the racial and ethnic groups, which traditionally have been underrepresented in our advanced science and engineering schools and professions. And it is to these non-traditional young people to whom we also must look for future scientists and engineers. Now, the quiet crisis is quiet because it's hard to see it coming. The true impact unfolds gradually over time. It takes decades to educate a biomolecular researcher or a nuclear engineer. It is a crisis because our national innovative capacity rests solely upon their talents and upon their ability to be excited to and interested in the marvels of science and engineering, to the wonders of discovery and innovation. So what can we all carry away from this very complex picture? In summary, and as a way to help frame our understanding, I would suggest that we think in terms of BTUs, not the British thermal units of energy or heat, but behaviors, technologies, and underlying principles. We must create the incentives and, where appropriate, disincentives and the level of awareness needed to alter individual behaviors, corporate behaviors, and, leading by example, governmental behaviors. We must reshape our investment in existing technologies, including renewal and upgrading of key elements of energy infrastructure, and support basic research to exploit the promise of new technologies. And we must do all of this strategically, according to a coherent set of underlying principles. These BTUs will form the basis of a comprehensive energy security roadmap. We are 3 months out from national elections, giving us ample opportunity to query the presidential candidates on their energy security plans. To achieve a comprehensive, nationally, globally linked energy plan will require the full weight and leadership of the nation's chief executive, as well as strong coordinated leadership in the Congress and at the state level. Only stability and consistency of outlook and linked federal and state regulatory policies and incentives can give us a roadmap that will make a real difference. These elements are important in order to provide signals and confidence to the corporate and financial communities that invest in new energy systems and technologies, and to capture those investments in new energy markets and ensure that they make business sense. Our leadership in these matters must be compelling and convincing, or we will lose the moment, lose the inherent economic opportunities, and relinquish global energy security leadership to others. Thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to address your questions.
Our thanks to Dr. Shirley Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, speaking on the subject of an energy roadmap for America. Dr. Jackson, we have a number of questions, so let's begin. So I'm going to lead off with two audience questions, which I'm going to combine. And this one says, what specific advice would you give to the incoming president to focus the first 100 days in office in order to get the country on a path towards energy security? And the second question is very similar, but it looks asking for the two or three most promising initiatives.
Well, I think there are two bits of advice for the first 100 days. One is to begin the conversation about the underlying principles that have to govern a comprehensive approach to energy security and not trivialize and make simple what is a complex problem. But the second, which others have spoken about as well, is to simply pluck the low-hanging fruit. And the low-hanging fruit has to do with conservation and efficiency. There are any number of things that can be done, ranging from really having tougher CAFE standards for automobiles and trucks. These things are possible to meet using new composite materials that already exist and new ultra-light, ultra-high-strength steel, and as well as by simply managing how traffic is managed and as well as how engines and transmissions are optimized and tuned. These are things that are pretty straightforward and can save us 20 to 30% in that sector alone. So the real thing is to pluck the low-hanging fruit and to begin to put some chits into the game in terms of laying out the underlying principles that have to govern a comprehensive energy strategy, and to get certain things pushed through the Congress along those lines.
And can you tell us how to accomplish that?
Well, I mean, politicians do know how to build, when needed, bipartisan coalitions. You know, I used to chair the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as you now know, and nuclear power is people react to it as if it were a social issue. In fact, I think it is one. And I learned that one has to work in a bipartisan way in the Congress, that it is possible even working with people who have very disparate perspectives on that issue. And it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of focus and a lot of commitment, and it takes a willingness to use up one's chits, which inevitably one will.
Naturally, you're looked at for good reason as especially well-informed on nuclear energy, and there were several audience questions about that. Let me just read them. The first is, what is your opinion about nuclear energy options, especially fusion, and how far away is that? And then the two almost identical questions about how, is there a reasonable, reliable way to actually dispose of nuclear waste from power?
Okay. Well, for those who may not be the experts, fusion has to do with merging nuclei and having energy generated. Fission, which is what all the current nuclear plants are based on, means splitting nuclei to generate energy. Obviously, fusion, and I'm not an expert in fusion research, but it is theoretically possible. The difficulty always seems to be that it's always over the next hill. And so it's hard for me to make an absolute projection on when we may see that. But it is research that I think is well worth doing, because it is a theoretical possibility, but certainly along the way, the research will generate a lot of knowledge about those processes that have spill-off in many arenas, and will teach us many things about the use of new materials and confinement mechanisms and things like that, which are useful. With respect to nuclear waste from current fission reactors, I think people have a perspective that there are essentially one of two ways to deal with the waste. One is to dispose of it in some appropriate geologic formation. That is technically feasible. There are questions about geologic stability over the time frames that one would need to store the waste before it had reached a level of diminished radioactivity and toxicity. And that's where a lot of the arguments lie, particularly as it relates to Yucca Mountain. But it is theoretically possible. In looking at that possibility, I want to remind people that de facto, we store waste at 70 sites around the country, because we store them at existing nuclear plant sites. And we store them in casks, we store them in pools, we store them above ground, and we store them semi-submerged. So I'll just kind of leave that thought with you. And if Yucca Mountain opened tomorrow, it would take about a decade to move all of that fuel to that site. The other way to, quote-unquote, close the fuel cycle is essentially to separate certain fission products from residual usable fuel material. And in the case of most uranium-based reactors, that material is plutonium. But plutonium can be blended with uranium. Plutonium oxide can be blended with uranium oxide to produce a so-called mixed oxide fuel that can be burned in conventional reactors. So there are those who argue that we should take the energy content from spent fuel. That also has the added benefit that it reduces the volume of the waste. Initially, that volume reduction is a 90% reduction. One ends up with 10% of the effective volume. On the other hand, and there always is another hand, two things are challenges. One is less of a challenge than the other, and that is to stabilize the leftover radionuclides. One has to essentially stabilize them to dispose of them in some kind of material, a borosilicate glass or a ceramic, and that essentially has the effect of bulking the waste back up. But one still has a reduction where one ends up at about one-third the amount of effective waste. But one still then has to dispose of it or store it for a period of time. But the half-life of what's left is at least an order of magnitude or two less than what one starts with. The other problem that people have seen with reprocessing spent fuel has to do with separating the plutonium. And people worry about it in terms of nuclear proliferation and its use in weapons. And so there are new approaches to reprocessing that people are looking at that wouldn't have a complete separation. And people are also looking at new reactor designs to breed fuel that then can be immediately reused, et cetera. So there are many possibilities. But with the current plants, then one ends up with fuel that's essentially plutonium embedded in a toxic matrix, although plutonium is about the most toxic in and of itself. And so one thinks about geologic disposal or reprocessing.
Thank you. Al Gore recently put forth the challenge of generating 100% of our electricity from renewable sources. Is this possible in 10 years, as he, I think, indicates? And what sources and percentages of those sources would make up the total?
Well, You know, I'm one who is very careful about predicting specific sources because part of the difficulty we've had with a quote-unquote energy strategy is that everyone has their favorite choice. And so, of course, there's wind, there's solar, there's geothermal, there are others that are in principle renewable sources. But part of the message, and so, yes, I think it is theoretically possible to do that. Part of the message, however, that I've tried to convey in my remarks is that there is a cost and there's an effect for every choice one makes, and one has to look at the complete fuel cycle costs, both environmental, and that includes manufacturing components. It implies finding and drilling holes everywhere for geothermal. It implies that one can site facilities in communities. And that so there are a lot of legal and regulatory issues that relate. And then there's the question about storage, because many of these sources, particularly solar and wind, are more intermittent sources. And so one has to think about how one garners the energy when one can and stores it and transmits it for later use. And so these are non-trivial complexities. And but this is why a new president has to get started fast.
Earlier in your remarks, you indicated that no country in the world is energy independent. And I assume by that you mean that every country imports at least some kind of energy. But on a net basis, thinking of the United States, we're clearly not, even on a net basis, energy independent. So is it feasible to think of getting to the point where we're exporting as much as we're importing in terms of, on some aggregate basis, in terms of energy?
Well, I think if you think of that kind of balance, which is what I actually mean when I talk about redundancy of supply and diversity of source, where one spreads the risk and one has a balance in source, both, you know, from where one gets a given source of energy, as well as source in the sense of type of energy generation, then yes, I think that is theoretically possible. But we would have thought we had that balance at some level today. But in terms of exports equaling imports, I think it depends upon how and what technologies are deployed. But let me give you a trivial example of non-energy independence. Suppose we had a freight liner, an airplane, that flies from here to pick the country of your choice. And we fly it on a fuel that we work out, but it happens not to have an engine that can fly on the fuel that another country works out. How's it getting back? And that's, in a way, it's funny. It sounds funny. But that's why one needs nationally but globally linked solutions to these things. And so we can't just think of it as something we're going to work out by ourselves and our exports equaling our imports. It really has to do with, you know, how will transportation in particular be handled? You know, how do we generate electricity, climate change, carbon dioxide load in the atmosphere? These are global issues. And, you know, the hard lesson people learned after Chernobyl about nuclear power is that a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident anywhere. And that caused those in the nuclear community to come together in ways they had not to that point, to really work together to the global cause of nuclear safety.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Dr. Shirley Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. As I indicated in my introduction, you are vice chair of the Council on Competitiveness. And this audience member's question says, In June, the Council on Competitiveness renewed its call for the presidential candidates to discuss how each would advance a comprehensive strategy for global energy security, productivity, and sustainability. What has been the response of the two candidates? If no response, how will the Council on Competitiveness press this issue in the campaign?
The Council has invited the candidates or their key policy people in this arena, in the energy arena, to come and talk and with the Council, its steering committee for the initiative, and its executive committee this summer. And we expect at least those policy advisors to come and to talk with us about it and to address our questions. So that is what has happened in the interim.
This audience member is concerned that a carbon tax, if we enacted it, would lead to higher prices, which hurts poor people everywhere. So how can we equitably convert to new sources without higher prices for food, medicine, transit, and so forth?
Well, that's an important question, and I think one can address it in two ways. One, when I talk about full life cycle costs, it has embedded in it the related questions about source, about where a given source plays out into the economy, whether it plays through the food chain, plays through the pharmaceutical chain, etc. And one has to understand what the derivative impacts are of substitution of petroleum-based products and processes in each of these arenas, and they are more than most people understand. Second has to do with infrastructure for delivery of energy and how that affects people who live in certain kinds of environments, in urban environments, etc. And a third has to do with potential government intervention, having to do with a kind of quid pro quo. Energy companies, particularly utilities in states, provide energy service. They go through public utility commissions, boards of public utilities, et cetera, and there are quid pro quos that are worked out in terms of how they treat different categories of customers. In the end, people have to pay their bills, but there are more structured arrangements that get worked out for people that have less means than for those who have more means. So all of these things need to come into play.
Thank you. And a big part of the solution in terms of getting congressional and presidential action on energy has to come from the citizenry and a push from a grassroots level. And what kind of movement is needed at the grassroots level? Or what do members of Congress and the administration need to see from us?
I think there are several things. I think, one, members of Congress are, by definition, responsive to their constituencies, particularly large numbers of their constituents. And for them to then hear from and understand from large numbers of their constituents that people are willing to take on the challenge to do a number of the things that we need to do to get to a different place with respect to energy security is one. Secondly, I think there needs to be a coalition or multiple coalitions that get built across the sectors. That's why I am involved with the Council on Competitiveness, because it brings together major corporate CEOs, major primarily research university presidents, and labor leaders to talk about the issues and to make proposals. And so when members of the Congress and see that groups are coming together across a broad front, groups that lobby on one side or the other typically, and sometimes with divergent interests, that has more impact than you might believe. So, for instance, there is a law that it's on the books. It's called the America Competes Act, which was meant to address competitiveness issues for the United States. And it focuses on everything from R&D tax credits to investment in basic research to financial support for undergraduate and graduate students studying science and engineering and so on. And it came about because there was an initiative on the part of the Council on Competitiveness that brought together the groups I mentioned that in the end played through the House of Representatives. And much of what came out of the National Innovation Initiative of the Council ended up in the House-sponsored legislation. On the other hand, there was Senate legislation that directly took its language from a National Academies assembled group that brought together, again, some university presidents, some corporate leaders, members of the Academy, Nobel Prize winners, and even public school educators who put together a report called Rising Above the Gathering Storm. It made a number of recommendations. Some of them overlapped with the council and vice versa, but there were some that were different. And essentially that language ended up in the Senate legislation. And then when they were the two draft legislative bills were reconciled, we got the American Competes Act. And so it actually is a great start. The difficulty is it hasn't been funded yet.
Aha. Getting back to alternative forms of energy, I've been keeping up with the German approach to solar is extremely extensive. They have a strong government subsidy for solar, and they're trying to achieve a very high penetration of solar. Have they gone too far? I mean, is that too expensive? What is the degree of subsidy there, or is it something that we might actually emulate?
Well, I think one has to be careful to talk about whether a given country has gone too far or not. Different countries are going to make different decisions depending upon the exigencies of their own economies, their geography, their supply situation, their weather. And then it also plays into the culture of the country and how decisions are made. And what that part of the reason I spent the time early on to talk a little bit about the global scene is that here, you know, we're pretty market-driven. Not that markets don't drive other places, but in many other countries, there's a lot more intertwining of what we call the corporate with what is governmental. So let's move away from Germany and talk about France. Now, France, in many ways, is in the catbird seat. It generates almost 80% of its electricity from nuclear power, so much so that it is a net exporter of electricity. But that decision to have that much of the electrical generation come from nuclear power was not something that was a pure market-driven decision. It was a governmental decision based on how France saw its energy needs and how it would give itself its greatest protection. And so we'll see, because then the market does come into play in terms of the choices people make and the sustainability. And so I think we'll see.
One of the strengths of this country is the capacity for public-private cooperation, it seems to me, and I've been seeing a number of examples of that. Recently, I was at a conference of resources for the future.
Oh yes.
And they laid out a program for an energy policy, which I think is being taken quite seriously in various quarters. So, what kinds of public-private cooperation deserve the most support in terms of achieving energy security?
Well, of course, I have to always begin with the sector I represent, which has to do with university government cooperation. But as well, many universities are engaged in various fundamental research projects and ones that one would call more prototypical research projects through partnerships with industry. And you know, I'm one who believes that one ought to have 1,000 flowers bloom, but have the government lay out a broad framework to create the kind of consistency of outlook, incentives where they can work, and then let the players play and let the markets work.
We have time for one last question for our speaker, Dr. Shirley Jackson, and this is from an audience member. How do we meet the technological challenges of the future with a high school dropout rate of 24% in California?
you have a problem. I think it relates to what I call the quiet crisis. You know, it really does take decades to educate a high-performing scientist or engineer. And that means it takes an early commitment and a staying power. And it is true, then, that we don't have the young people coming along, and some of that is rooted in the quality of our science and math education. I don't put that on the young people because we all own it. And I think it is naive to think that we're going to be a global leader down the line if we don't think we should invest in our own human resources. Secondly, more than most Americans appreciate, we today depend upon a huge reservoir of talent that has come from abroad. Something like 40%, close to 40% of the PhDs in science and engineering in this country currently were born somewhere else, and about 30% of the master's level people in these fields. And so in the end, we better think about then immigration policy, but we better think concomitantly about elevating the educational level of all of our citizens, if for no other reason, because too often, and people want to delink things, and let me say what I mean by that. 50% of our graduate students at Rensselaer are foreign-born. They're from other places. Excellent students. But we are also concerned about domestic supply and development. And so we think it has to be an all-in proposition. Plus, we all have a stake in elevating the general public knowledge about science and engineering and its challenges, because in the end, what happens in that arena, in the arena of science and engineering, what the policies that support and help to drive innovation are going to come out of a larger public consensus. And that public consensus requires an educated citizenry and people with more knowledge in these fields than we have heretofore been concerned about.
Our thanks to Dr. Shirley Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, for her remarks here this evening on building an energy roadmap for security, energy security. I'm Kerry Curtis. I shouldn't admit it right now. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, observing more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.
I have to go to my class now, so I'll be back.